Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1306 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser. Sveriges enda konservativa podcast om amerikansk politik med mig, Ronny Berggren, som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0. I detta avsnitt följer ett spännande samtal med den amerikanske valkonsulten Ryan Shafik från Pennsylvania om vad det innebär att arbeta i amerikanska valkampanjer och om den polarisering som nu råder i USA. Varmt välkomna. Ryan Shafik, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are a political consultant in Pennsylvania in the United States, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But, you know, first, could you tell me a little bit about yourself, your background and things like that?
Sure. As you said, I live in the United States. I reside in Pennsylvania. I grew up in Maryland, actually, and I've been pretty interested in politics since high school. And I come with the philosophy that politics is too important to be left to only politicians. So everybody should be involved or thinking of how they can get involved to influence, I think, their elected officials. So I started in high school as volunteers on campaigns, Congress, certain presidential campaigns. I attended Bob Dole's rally, if you remember him.
Yeah.
Came to one of the VFW near my house. That was pretty interesting. So from there, I just, you know, and through college, I started working on various congressional campaigns, interning for senators, officials, and then I gravitated towards the campaign aspect of it. Some people gravitate towards policy because they're very good at policy. I liked the campaign aspect of it. So I eventually, after probably 10 years of working on campaigns, on and off, being hired in different positions, manager, communications director, whatever you have, I went solo and opened up my own company where I could assist as many candidates as I could, who I thought that I believed in, you know, to change the way the country's going and the state is going, because I do a lot of state and federal office work.
Yeah. And you know, since you mentioned Bob Dole, I assume you are a conservative.
Yeah. I mean, so I tend to only work for Republicans who are more libertarian, small L conservative, independent of the establishment. So they're not people who are going to be brought up and part of the political swamp or political class. That's kind of been my people know me as that. That's kind of my reputation. And to me, it's more fulfilling because I'd rather work for one or two people I truly believe in who I think can change things than work for a whole host of people who are basically going to do nothing.
Yeah. But before we get into the political stuff, you have actually, you know, this is a podcast in Sweden, and I know that you have actually lived here in Sweden. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So I studied in Sweden in my university. I lived in Flemingsberry and I went to Stockholm University for a semester, and I loved it. It's a great country. Sweden's a great place. I came back a few years later, and I was an assistant to a friend of mine who was an English teacher, and he also taught social studies in Huddinge commune, which is just south. And I had a great time there too. And, you know, you get to see the differences of the countries. There's a lot of similarities as well. But I was really impressed by Sweden. I still obviously like the country a lot. I think I think more Americans should know about it. They don't. They think it's polar bears and chocolate, thinking Switzerland and Sweden are the same, or confusing them with. Yeah, I've been back. I have a good amount of friends there. I still see. I've been hoping to get back there. Last year, my plans were kind of shelved because of this mess. But yeah, I definitely hope to get back there.
One thing I've noticed before we continue is that liberals in America usually romanticize Sweden and, you know, talk about the Swedish welfare state and, you know, America should become like Sweden and things like that. How common is that to, you know, to hype up Sweden among you, you know, your liberal friends?
Yeah, so that was kind of a talking point of the left, like we should be more like Sweden this. And I kind of think it's funny because there's a lot of things in Sweden that are more conservative policy-wise. For example, school choice is a big in Sweden. You can go to any school, you know, which is something conservatives in the U.S. have been fighting for, but the unions have been fighting it on state levels. Certain states have it, though. So whenever I bring that up, I'm like, okay, you want to be like Sweden? Well, let's have universal school of choice. Oh, we can't have that. And then they don't realize also, you know, Sweden is under 10 million. The U.S. is 330 plus million, many different states. And Sweden has a very pro-entrepreneurial, they've economically liberalized since they've gotten better. They've moved in a better direction than us in a lot of aspects. So I think that's an old talking point. Bernie Sanders sometimes uses it to, you know, talk about his national socialized healthcare. But I'd say now too, conservatives are starting to point out, you know, use Sweden, unfortunately, in a negative way, pointing towards the mass immigration policies and the no-go zones that are in the country, and just the radical transformation that unlimited, unfettered immigration can have in a country, especially in a country where you can't even debate it. You're called racist for bringing it up. So that's where, unfortunately, it's starting to come back. And as you know, President Trump, when he was in office, he brought a light to that.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And, you know, a lot of liberals, they don't really believe what's happening in Sweden right now, because it's true. You know, we have mass migration to Sweden and it's not working out very good. And I have a friend who actually studied at Harvard. And when he told his liberal teachers that, the picture you paint of Sweden, it's not correct. We have a lot of problems. They didn't even believe it. It was so, you know, far from their imagination about Sweden.
Yeah, and it's funny because most of them have never been there. They've never been to Sweden. So when you try to tell them, when I taught, I would tell you half my students were immigrants or refugees or this, and the one difference I did see was a lot of the refugees and the kids I taught were very good kids, but there was definitely a different cultural disconnect. And what I mean by this is in the U.S., a lot of kids will say, I'm an American. They'll say I'm an American. These kids said, I'm not Swedish. I'm Syrian. I'm Afghan. I'm not. I mean, they said that to me. It was unsolicited. And they lived in different parts that are completely segregated. So and this was 15 years ago. I was getting that. And I kind of thought that was very interesting. Just that they didn't consider themselves Swedish. Whereas most Americans, you go to a lot of school, even if you go to schools where their kids come from all over, they're assimilated a lot, you know, more into U.S. culture and can consider themselves Americans.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about politics now. You said you have been interested in politics since your teens, and in 2009 you started a company, Rockwood Strategies. Can you tell me a little bit about your company?
Sure. So in the United States, you have kind of these consulting firms that run campaigns, and usually you have Republican firms and Democrat firms, right? There's not much cross. So obviously me being more conservative and a Republican at the time, I started a Republican one. However, I differentiated myself in that I wanted to only work with people I believed in and who would challenge kind of the system, right? So every other firm out there was one that took their cues from the political establishment. They got business from the Senate, House, Republican Party, and they had to do whatever they said. So they couldn't take a race against another Republican in a primary. That I wanted to be completely independent because I'm an ideas guy. I'm a person who's in it for the ideas, for because I believe that ideas are the things that drive things. But the party establishment does not like that. They want to be able to control. So I started, my group was, I work with a lot of conservative groups that are principled based with ideas, free market, limited government. And I take candidates in that same vein, with that same philosophy. So I started that, and I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen or not. And I just started doing it and getting more and more. And I've been doing it for now on my own for 12 years now. And I'm still doing it. I'm doing more now, teaching seminars, going to be doing that. I would teach over the years, I would teach how to run for office. So I'm trying now to do more teaching of that and more groups of conservative leaders and candidates in different states, because in the United States, you know, your congressman or senator was probably a state legislator, right? So you got to get these people early and train them early and build what is called a bench, right? Like a bench and a team. So I'm kind of interested in making sure we have strong states at leaders, because those state leaders become congressmen and senators who may become presidents.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about some of your most famous clients?
So I worked with probably the most famous client that your listeners may know internationally. I mean, Senator Pat Toomey was one of my first. In fact, I worked with him back in 2004 when he ran against a Republican senator as a volunteer. I helped him in 2010. He didn't win that race, but he ran in 2010, and we won by 2 points. That was a long night. I remember that election night in a hotel in Allentown. And it wasn't until maybe midnight or 1 o'clock that we finally got the results. I helped a state Senate candidate in Pennsylvania who won the first write-in candidacy. That means their name wasn't on the ballot.
Yeah.
And they won. And that was a pretty big race. He eventually went on to run for governor very unsuccessfully. I wasn't involved in that race. That's another story. But getting him to the Senate, he made national news. And I mean, it was the only one in the history of the state to ever win a write-in like that. That was definitely a big one. I have a couple good races going up against. I think I mentioned to you, when you run against a Republican incumbent, because we have the primary, that's where all the enemies come out. That's where everything gets really nasty, and you see who you're. I always say you'll know who your true friends are in a primary election.
Yeah.
And we went after this one guy in 2012 who was an incumbent state legislator in Pennsylvania. He ran. He was very powerful in the state of Pennsylvania. And he was, I think he was corrupt to the core. And that was a nasty race. And we had a free market guy. He was like a professor. He was like Adam Smith, capitalism. And that was a great race where we did some very fun ads there. And we won that by 2 points. That one was definitely a good one. Do a lot of work with independents. So in the U.S., we have what is called political action committees. And political action committees do independent work. So you have the campaign committee. Like, for example, Pat Toomey has a Senate campaign committee. But then you have all these other committees that cannot coordinate by law. But they spend tens of millions of dollars trying to influence the race.
Like super PACs.
Super PACs. Yeah, that's one of them. Super PACs is the most common. You have 527s. You have 501c4s. I mean, there's a million different ones. Super PACs are the most common. But I do work like that too. So typically that's kind of my favorite, because then I don't have to deal with the candidate, because you can just do creative stuff. And you just do, they hire you and they trust you, and you're like, yeah, I propose X, Y, and Z. And it's pretty seamless and easy, and you can do some fun stuff.
Yeah, but you know, there is a big difference in political culture between Sweden and the United States, and Sweden is I love Sweden, of course, but we have a very boring political system, and the United States basically has the opposite. I can't even think about any other political system in the whole world or in the history of the whole world which has such a entertaining political system as the United States. I don't know if you agree with that, but since you are in it, can you tell me a little about you? You said that you preferred campaigns before policy. Is that because of this, like the energy, the fighting spirit, and things like that? Yeah.
So I think I'll tell you one of the funny stories. So back in college, when I was working for U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, you might have heard of him.
I know him. Yeah.
So I he was a senator from Pennsylvania, and when you're an elected official, you have your government office, which is taxpayer-funded policy, no campaigning. And then you have campaigns. So I was in college, and I remember going down and interning at his office in Philadelphia. his government office. It was boring as hell. Okay. It was just, I mean, it was like, hey, where's my Medicare payment? Where's my Social Security? Why are helicopters flying over Fairmont Park? Are they going to, are aliens? I mean, just, I'm like, I don't want to deal with this. Right. Or just, I didn't like that. So that, at that same time, I was volunteering on a campaign, and I remember going to a campaign. We were trying to get rid of a Democrat congressman. So the Republican had won. I had come back from Sweden, actually. I had just come back from Sweden, and it was the summer of 2000, and I remember going to this campaign office, and I want you to picture this rundown house with no description. Looks like, right? It looks like it could be a jail. Grass is overgrown. You walk in, it's the light is dim, the coffee's burnt, it smells like smoke. And I just thought to myself, I feel at home here. You know, but you know, there were decisions. It was, I just was drawn to the battle. I was drawn to the strategy. There's a lot of similarities in campaign tactics. It's kind of like a bloodless war. It just is. In the US, it's a bloodless war. In some campaigns, there is blood. I mean, unfortunately, but it's just, I guess I'm drawn to the energy, the rush. There's a lot of excitement, and that's always interested me. You know, I guess persuasion, convincing people, marketing campaigns. That has excited me. I have a lot of friends on the other aisle who work. I mean, not political aisle, but They work, they're policy guys, they're brilliant writers, but they don't want anything to do with campaigns.
You know, continue, please.
No, go ahead.
You know, there was this television show a couple of years ago, House of Cards, and a lot of Swedes watched that. And, you know, that's how they, you know, found Netflix, basically, here in Sweden. Yeah. And, you know, how similar is House of Cards to reality?
So there is some... There is some similarity in the, however, I will say that some of the stuff is a little over dramatized, like the sketchiness, the kind of the back dealing. I mean, in House of Cards, you had a guy who was murdering people. Like, I don't think you'd see the Speaker of the House murder or push people in front of trains. However, the basic vibe of it is true. And there's always some, like, I'll give you a good example. There was, if you want to hear a quick story about campaign. So there was a campaign, we were going up against the majority leader in Pennsylvania of the Senate. And he had this guy, House of Cards like character, who was a dirty trickster, you know, dive and dumpster, do stuff. And he was notorious, and we had to get him on the record. What happened was our underdog candidate was, we were outspent like 1.5 million to 100,000. So 15 times outspent. But what happened was he had such a bad reputation that he one of our candidate's workers, his cat was killed. It was like found dead. So and then there were signs for our opponent in the neighborhood. So there started this story that he killed the cat. So we got this to the radio, and it went all over the media, and it blew up everywhere that this guy had killed people's cats. And he held a press conference, and they kept saying, "Did you kill the cat?" He's like, "I had nothing to do with the cat." And we found out in the end he had nothing to do with it, but it was just raising the question. Yeah. And he lost by 33. He got destroyed like that next day. I mean, it was just. But that was an example of like this dirty trickster. A rumor got started. It got to the radio. We sent it to the SPCA, which is the Society for the Protection of Cruelty of Animals of that area. And then the media heard there and investigate, and it just. And that guy got, and he was so angry because afterwards he was like, I didn't, you know, the dirty trickster was revealed, And he's like, I swear I didn't kill. And he still talks about being blamed for killing this cat. So.
Yeah, poor guy. But I assume he knew what to get into. But, you know, yeah. Okay. So the political system in Pennsylvania, can you tell me a little about that? Because, you know, during the presidential race last year, Pennsylvania got, you know, very central to Donald Trump. So basically, how does the political system in Pennsylvania work? I know that Democrats rule most of it.
Well, are you talking about the state legislature or the electoral like?
Well, you can comment both.
Okay. So Pennsylvania, the reason a lot of people know Pennsylvania, Ronnie, as you know, there's a in the U.S. elections, there's probably a handful of states that swing the election, right?
Yeah.
So where I was born in Maryland, Maryland is a Democrat state. It will never be Republican in my lifetime. So it's not even competitive. You come up to Pennsylvania. Our TV is jammed with ads. You can't do it. I mean, it's one of the five states, and then it was probably the top three this year. So it's competitive. It's a 50-50 state. It's very close. Trump won it by a half a point in 2016. Biden won it by 1.2. I mean, it's very close. So because of the competitive nature, you have tons of money. You have tons of interest. You have tons of everything, international interest. So speaking politically, on a state legislature, you have a Democrat governor, but you have Republicans who control the House and Senate. So there's some which is good because it's not as bad as some of these other states. The Governor Wolf is an awful governor, though. He's just been horrible on these lockdowns. He has the nursing home scandals. So on that level, I would describe it as competitive, the state. Okay, it's not written off like these other states, like New York, California, New Jersey. Forget it. They're done. You know, politically, they're just one party Democrat states. Election wise, the reason it got so much controversy and was because Pennsylvania switched to no excuse mail-in voting. Now, typically in an election, when you do an election in Pennsylvania, up until 2020, you would have 8% of the votes are cast on election day. And you could still do an absentee. You just have to. Well, now with the pandemic and this no excuse absentee, it was record. I mean, you talk about. And what happened was you had all the Democrats virtually voting by mail. And you had virtually only maybe 20% of Republicans voting by mail. One of the reasons was Trump was trashing mail-in vote. That's all he was doing. So Republicans listened to him and didn't vote. Democrats hating Trump did the opposite. So what you had is Pennsylvania has a very old system in that it's all by county. See, in the election system, you got to understand every state, it's state-based and it's county-based. So you got to look at it by that. So you go into Pennsylvania, you got 67 counties. Then you got a city like Philadelphia, which is the largest, it's Philadelphia County. And they're now, they had over 1 million ballots to cast through mail. That's unheard of. They're not prepared for that. I mean, the Philadelphia system was not prepared. That's why it took 8-9 days to more than that. You know, you saw when it took forever. And a lot of these counties were never set up or prepared for that. Then you add the pandemic. So then you add the Supreme Court, which is Democrat. By the way, the Supreme Court is another critical function. That's all Democrat in Pennsylvania. So the Supreme Court rewrote laws, the election law, and that sowed a lot of doubt among Republicans because they took law and just rewrote the signature requirement law. They rewrote the postmark, and that really, really created a lot of distrust among Republicans and some independents. And that's what led to a lot of the stop the steal and a lot of this stuff. Because when you have election law, you have a legislature and you have a you go through the legislative process. What drives people nuts is when judges come in and just, I'm going to change it. And that's what they did. So yeah. That you add that, Ronnie, that just sowed so much doubt.
Yeah, but, you know, does that mean that the election was stolen? Or what do you think about, you know, Trump's claim, you know, the, you know, stop the steal and everything?
So I always said when Trump said that, I said, you know, he's giving the Democrats too much credit. They're not competent enough to steal something this, they're not, to put together a plan this ambitious. They're just not that smart. Okay. I think what happened was this. you have five states, Ronnie, that were of question. Three were controlled by Democrats, two by Republican. They're all different voting systems. They're all different counties. They're all different Secretary of States. What happened was there was a lot of confusion. There were some irregularities, and I don't doubt that. But was it this huge conspiracy? I don't think the Dems, like I said, are competent to pull something off. And I also think in Pennsylvania, you did have some irregularities, but was it enough to sway the election? It doesn't look like it. But here's the problem. That's not good for our system. The fact that the Supreme Court could arbitrarily completely could change stuff, change things. Then you had issues of, you know, and when they change it, you're talking about ballots that were legal, now considered illegal or uncounted. And that's just sowing complete doubt and distrust. That's not good for anybody. So was the number enough to sway Pennsylvania? It doesn't look like it. If you add it up, it talked about 10 to 12,000, but still you shouldn't have 10 to 12,000, you know, that are in doubt. I mean, you should have a system that is bulletproof. And like I said, I think the big thing that was a huge shock, and we never were used in Pennsylvania to this much. Each county was just bombarded by these mail-in ballots. I mean, and counties were overwhelmed, and they took their time processing because everyone was watching them. Yeah. So that's why they were slow. They didn't want to make a mistake. They had to get signature verification. It was a complete mess. And the politicians helped create it.
You mentioned signature verification. I mean, here in Sweden, as you might know, we have a very secure system. You know, the citizens get a voter card and are allowed into the, you know, to the ballot box to vote. And, you know, it's very difficult to cheat in Sweden, basically. And we have to show ID and things like that. And you don't have voter ID laws in most states in the United States. I mean, in general, how secure are American elections, would you say?
I think here's the thing. American elections are generally secure because, and I've said this the last 5 years, when you have, remember, look at Pennsylvania. You got 67 counties, right? And then each county has, like my county has 450 precincts, okay? Each precinct is manned by local people, and the election is plugged into the wall. It's not plugged into the internet. It's plugged into electrical. You can't hack that, you know? So, and then what they do is they print out, so you have the paper ballot, then they print out the election result. And if they do an audit, they look at the ballots to it, and they compare and say, okay, there's no discrepancy. So I have faith in that. I think it's secure, and a lot of states are. But the media completely exaggerated over the years, like this hacking. You know, when you kept hearing the hacking, this, yeah. They could hack into the Secretary of State offices of each state. Like for example, in Pennsylvania, you have Bucks County, you have Allegheny. Those counties are online, but you're not voting online. They're just tallying. Do you see what I mean? Like they're not going in and changing the votes in each precinct. And that's not plugged into the internet. And the media never reports this, which was to my – and I kept – because I would tell people, like, they're not reporting the truth about how it really works. And every state's different. Like, for example, Florida is a very good – has a very good – it has, you know, has same-day voting. It has early voting. It has mail-in voting. The results were by 11 p.m., okay? Yeah. But they've done it. They have a train. You get states that had never had this, and Pennsylvania was not allowed to count votes. So that's the other thing. Pennsylvania was not allowed to count votes until that day, whereas some of these other states you could count 2 weeks before. So that's why it was when you saw all the reporting, this state was this. There's no uniform system because in federalism you have different states, different systems, and I think they're all generally secure. I think like I said, with the changing of and some states require ID. I mean, I don't agree with the notion that you can go to any state. It's pretty easy to vote, Ronnie. I've moved to states. There's if you just register and you have to show an ID. It's not that hard. OK, you have to show an ID to buy a gun. You have to show an ID to get a liquor. You have to show ID, get on a plane. It's not hard. It's not discriminatory, like the left likes to say. But I think it's something that you got to understand. It's by state. And like the Georgia voting one, the Georgia law, you know, New York, New Jersey is much more strict than Georgia.
Oh, really? Okay.
They have less voting days. They have more voter ID. I mean, but again, the media and the left doesn't care about the truth. Hmm. It's just about, you know, and the one thing we did notice from this 2020 election is we do need to tighten up. States are tightening up their laws because of the distrust that happened from it. Pennsylvania, we're trying, but they're nowhere near. They're too far. See, the Republicans want to get rid of mail-in voting. That's never going to happen. But the, and then the Dems want to do this, and the Republicans. So I don't think you're going to, you may not see a compromise soon.
Mm. But, you know, Donald Trump, he basically said that, you know, the American electoral system is like a third world country. And I assume you do not agree. But, you know, when he says things like that, does the, I mean, according to me, that undermines the whole faith in the American system and in the American Republic. I think it's very dangerous to say that because he has millions of followers who basically believe that America is, well, when it comes to election, a third world country.
Yeah, I don't think that was helpful. I don't agree with that. I mean, you know Trump, that's his MO, he'll say stuff. I mean, if you remember in 2016, he said right before the election, if I lose, it was rigged. Well, he won by winning three states by less than a point. I mean, he won by a combined less than 80,000 votes in three states. And was it rigged then? I mean, it's like, and you know, it was an incredible feat. You know, he lost the popular vote, but every state's different. Like I said, I've never had issues. I think if anything, it's gotten better. You do have to be careful of some of these, like Philadelphia in the 50s, Ronnie was known for being very notorious for like fraud and corruption and voting, but it's completely different now with the computerization, you have the media more, it's not nearly as, prevalent. And the thing is, everybody, I don't know if you know, but whenever people talk about corruption in Pennsylvania, like voter, they always say, oh, the votes in Philly, they stole votes in Philly. Well, Donald Trump did better in Philly in 2020 than in 2016. So if you're going to steal an election, why would you let him do better in Philadelphia than, which is the most Democratic area? It's 8-1 Democrat.
Yeah.
Right? They control everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, unfortunately, some of the exaggerations and stuff, but Trump is right in that there was legitimate problems, but you don't, I think you do a disservice to the legitimate problems. Like I said, the Supreme Court going rogue in Pennsylvania, the other things that people have questions about and want to fix, those are legitimate, but you lose them when you just say blanketed stuff you can't substantiate.
Yeah. You know, before we continue here, you know, you mentioned that there used to be cheating and we know about shenanigans and things like that. How did, you know, I assume that happened in, you know, specific districts. How did that work and why is it not possible to cheat in the ways it was possible before?
I think the best example was the Kennedy election. Kennedy, Nixon, right? Mm. Because I think they, back then, they could stuff ballots, right? Like, so you go in there, you have your voter ID, they give you, you go vote and you leave. In certain cities where they were controlled, like you go to a city precinct and it's all Democrats of one party and the ballots are paper, you can just start filling and filling and that's how they would do it is more, you see? And there's no oversight, there's nothing. And there was some of that in Texas. Lyndon Johnson, the former president, in his race in Texas, I mean, there's a lot of talk of people stuffing the ballot box when he won. He won very barely when he won for the Senate. This is when he ran for Senate. But you talk about Kennedy in Chicago. There was notorious, you know, in these urban areas where there were quote, old political machines. They're not, the machine is kind of dead these days, that old tech, when you hear the machine, it is, I think it's mostly dead, it's a paper tiger. But back in the days, you know, the cities, you had, Democrat machines more than Republicans. There was a couple of Republicans in some counties, but they're mostly Democratic cities that had these machines, and they would just stuff the ballot, you know, just stuff it.
Hmm.
That was how they would supposedly get away with it.
And that's not possible these days.
You may have it in certain areas, but I haven't seen. I mean, I'm a big guy. I've shown me the proof. Like, you know, one of the things is you look at the voter rolls in the district, you look at the pass numbers, you look at, you know, the turnout statistics, you can kind of do an audit to see if there's an outlier of some sort. Is there some stuff? I mean, I think in any election, you may have one person, and they did, they'll catch one person requesting a ballot for their dead spouse, right? Which is stupid, because you're going to go to jail for what. But to pull off, I think in today's world with technology, texting, cameras, all this stuff that leaves an electronic footprint, it's very hard to organize any type of, let me go round up 500 votes, right? Like, can you imagine texting 500 people? Hey, I know you're not going to vote. Can I use your... I mean, you're going to have an electronic footprint. You know, the old saying, when one person knows, you know, 10 people know. When two people know, 200 people know. You know, it's just, I think it's much more difficult. And they caught a bunch of people doing it. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be aware or always be looking out and safe, but I don't think it's like it was in the 50s.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the whole corona situation. Here in Sweden, yeah, we basically have no lockdown whatsoever. And well, in the big cities like Stockholm and other cities, things are, you know, problematic. But I live in the countryside and life is just as it was 2019. No big difference, really. So, I mean, how is life in... it's very different in different states, but how is life in Pennsylvania?
Well... you're right. It's different in different states. Like, you know, California is completely locked down. Michigan is locked down. Pennsylvania is somewhat locked down. The problem, though, is also you have this, the big division, too, is the masks. The forced masking is now a political issue. So you go to California, a lot of places, not all of Pennsylvania, but there's a lot of Pennsylvania where, you know, the Democrats are the party of forced masking and having people, everyone's afraid of each other. So if you go down south to Florida, some of the states where it's optional, it's a lot more respectful. People are more friendly. People, you can wear one, that's fine if you don't. Whereas up here, up north in Democrat-run states and Democrat Biden's administration, it's, if you're not wearing a mask, you're killing someone, you're a horrible person in the meat. So it's very sad to see what's happening. That this, they're pitting people up against each other, because as we know, all these states that had lockdowns and masking, forced mask, not, and the key is forced. It's not voluntary. Because when it's forced, then you're turning everybody against each other. And that's what the government's done. And that's what the Democrats have done. So that's kind of the big division. So down south, you have open, it's definitely open. You have optional masking. Pennsylvania is forced masking, but things are opening up a little bit more. And a lot of people are, you go out to different parts of Pennsylvania because it's political. So you go in the city of Philadelphia, everyone's wearing a mask. Everyone's inside wearing a mask. You're getting shamed for not wearing a mask. You go out to where I live, it's 50-50. Certain places, they don't care. Certain places, it's, you know, they want to get over it. But like I said, and people are moving. So what's happening is you're seeing a great migration. People are fleeing California, New Jersey, New York. The real estate market is absolutely on fire where I am. Everyone's leaving New York. New York is just, it's like, you know, San Francisco is losing more people than any other city proportion. And it's funny. And I always say this to some of the Democrat leftist friends. I say, if you want to know a state's doing well, why is it all the Democrat states that are run by Democrats, people are leaving? And where are they going? Florida? Republican run, Tennessee, Arizona, Republican run, you know, South Carolina, all the states, Texas, they're all going there. No one's moving to New Jersey. No one's moving to New York. No one's moving to California. In fact, I'm 6 miles from New Jersey. There's a joke. If I sometimes go to New Jersey to get liquor because Pennsylvania has System Belaget. We have a stupid state-run store. It's awful. So I always say, Pennsylvania, your state is failing when you have to leave to go to New Jersey to get something. Yeah. That's your mark. You know your state is failing when that happens. So Yeah, so it's kind of sad because there are some nice places, but these are all one party Democrat states. Michigan too.
Yeah, does that mean that, you know, the Democratic politicians are like more disconnected to ordinary people than Republican politicians? Would you say that?
Yeah, and to be fair, as you know, I'm critical of all politicians, especially, and I'm not shy at criticizing Republicans, because there's a lot of bad Republican governors up north who are emulating exactly Democrat lockdown policies. But the Democrats are completely owned and bullied by the media, and the American media, the corporate corrupt media in our country, has completely fanned the flames of the pandemic and made it worse. There, you know, now the thing about the vaccine, oh, now Paul, there were 6 million doses of the vaccine, six of them caused clotting, and they stopped the Johnson & Johnson one. But Ronnie, it's everywhere. So again, they're making it, this is what they do. This is what the media has done. And the Democrats listen to everything the media says. And the media goes to Dr. Fauci, who I think time has come to retire, and he should step aside for somebody else, because he's not helping with his contradictory assessments. But they're completely, the Democrats are just, they're big media, big corporation, and they're completely disconnected, I believe. And a lot of people see it because they're fleeing the states. I mean, if people are voluntarily voting with their feet, you know, you're not doing a good job governing.
No, true. You know, we can, you know, let's talk a little bit more about the media. You know, the United States seems to be very polarized right now, a lot more polarized than Sweden or, you know, any Western country I can think of, actually. How much is, you know, is that media's fault? Media's fault completely?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think it is the media's fault. I think if you look in the U.S., we have CBS, NBC, MSNBC, ABC, CNN. Those are the big ones. I mean, they're the big ones. And they're all on the same page. I mean, they decide what becomes a news story. You know, for example, if the mainstream corporate media has a narrative of they wanted to get rid of Trump, so the virus was away, so they fan that. And then the other thing is they think America is a systemic racist country that hates black people and anyone who's not white. That's a fact. So they take any story and they take that story and make it a national story. So if you have a story in the United States that's, let's say, opposite of that, a crime where it's of opposite colors, they don't report it because it doesn't fit their narrative. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a national story. It's a local story. But when it's national and blown up all over the country and world, that so they pick and choose because they're in the pocket of the Democrat. They believe in the woke culture. They believe in cancel culture. Their whole business is to get eyeballs, and they're filled with progressive leftists. So you have on the right Fox News, which, you know, it's the only counterbalance. I still am not happy because they still too sometimes play into the oversensual. Like, there's no real down the middle independent journalism in this country, and Fox is the only counterweight to the left. But you know, the left will say they're just as bad on the right, and they have some merit. I agree with that, because I think it's that sensationalism too. They're playing to their base. But they're very small. I mean, the overwhelming media, you know, New York Times, Washington, they all follow the same thing. I mean, one story on ABC, it's going to be through the whole thing. And these are all corporate giants. And it is the most polarized I've seen. The polling shows it. 10% of Republicans trust any of the mainstream media, 75% of Democrats do, 30% of Republicans. So I would say, Ryan, this is the worst I've seen in my life. And it used to be good, like in the 60s when Walter Cronkite and people trusted. There is no trust in the media now.
How did this happen? Because what you're saying, that is basically that the media, you know, brings forth news that confirms their narrative. I mean, how did this happen? How could it, you know, even be possible?
I think it's always been left, but I think the 24-hour news system and social media, this we got to have something, and the fact that they're now the news division of a company, ABC or C, used to not be worried about profits, right? Well, now they're worried about profits and they want to make money off of it. and their audience, they know their audience is the left. So, I mean, and I'll give you another example, like the Obama administration, 91% of the coverage was positive.
Yeah.
Okay. Against Romney, like it was 88% negative. I mean, it just, everybody sees they're not journalists. And that's the sad thing is they masquerade as journalists and they're not. I don't care if they're left, but average, don't lie to us and say you're independent journalism. You're not. You're just not. I mean, Reuters maybe, AP maybe, PBS, you have very few, but these big news corporations, they're not journalists. And and the problem is the Democrat voters in the party, they believe them. They're like, oh, this is independent journalism. It's not. I get in arguments with my family who read the New York Times, who did, you know, a perfect example, though. You got the New York Times with the guy who shot up the massage parlors. The first thing was it's all about race. No, it wasn't about race. It was about because he was a sex-crazed weirdo. It had nothing to do. It happened to do with the sex parlors were mostly Asian employees. It wasn't race. You know, usually these people in mass shootings will tell you if it's about, you know, like the synagogue shooting we had. I mean, the guy was very anti-Semitic. So, but the media didn't care. So they just ran with that story everywhere. The 60 Minutes hit piece on Ron DeSantis. And that, thank God you're getting blowback, people. But I wish there was independent journalism that would call out, but you don't have it because...
But you know, something that I think should have been a wake-up call is because this polarization is obviously very dangerous. And a couple of, I don't know if it was years ago or months ago, we had Ellen DeGeneres. She's a left-wing, you know, TV show host who went to, I think it was a baseball match together with George W. Bush, a Republican. And they basically are friends, at least in private. And they went to this baseball match and they posted a picture on Facebook, on social media. And everyone on the left got all, you know, they became just totally crazy and said that Ellen DeGeneres, you're a betrayer and things like that. And she is actually very left-wing, Ellen DeGeneres. But she couldn't even post a picture together with a friend because that friend was a Republican president. And
I think that's a good point. And I think, you know what that is? That's social media and Twitter. So I think Twitter is one of the most toxic things in the world. It's the outrage mob is on Twitter. Everybody, you see a lot, you hear, what you hear in politics today too is stop playing to Twitter. Twitter is basically a bunch of people on it who think their opinion's important. The average person is on Twitter. The average voter doesn't care, but they all talk to each other. So they all think they're important and everybody's in their own universe. So you put something on Twitter, somebody who's sitting is not doing anything. The outrage mob who has no life, doesn't do anything. All they do is attack. And guess what? Then the media, Ronnie, takes that and makes that a story. Oh, this is one of my biggest pet peeves is the news media, the corporate corrupt news media will take 5 or 6 tweets from average people who saw the Ellen DeGeneres and it was started and say, this is awful, blah, 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 this. And they'll do a national story, people angry. No, that's 5 or 6 people. Did you conduct a national poll and pay and do a survey if people are really angry? No, you took 5 comments, and that, Ronnie, is everywhere. That's garbage journalism. That's sensationalism. But that's what we have. And that's what creates this mob of people just attacking.
I totally agree. But, you know, I would assume that, you know, big news corporations and journalists would understand that in a democratic system, which you have in the United States and in all of, you know, Western Europe, thanks to the United States. But, you know, you would think that they would understand that in a democratic system, you can fight on the political arena, but you need to separate the political arena from the, you know, the private sphere or, you know, the public in general. But, you know, you seem to totally have lost that in the United States, because here in Sweden, we can have tough debates, but, you know, you can still be friend on, you know, watching hockey games and things like that. You know, that seems to totally have disappeared in the United States. And my question is, you know, why does, how come that these journalists does not understand that?
I think it's they're playing the journal. Like one of the things I mentioned is the journalists today, quote, let's call them journalists. I call them propagandists. Their audience is to inflame these radical left wing, you know, the consumer of their product. And the consumer of their product, is very left-wing and wants to hear all the social, perceived social injustice or whatever, and get outraged. Like I said, they're waiting to be outraged, and it's now infected to a place where the corporations pulled out of the All-Star game and the baseball game, which is a complete joke over a bill that, you know, so many lies. But the corporate America, you know, is one of the most, I mean, they're as corrupt too. They're afraid of the left. They're in bed with them now because they don't want to be targeted. So what they do is they fold. And they used to not be in politics. The NFL, same thing. You know, they had the protests. They support Black Lives Matter group, which I don't care what people think about a political group. I don't think sports people should be, and the NFL or MLB should be weighing in on this stuff. And their ratings have suffered completely, and they should. I just think the NFL is it's not even good anymore. I think it's just, but it, other people, it's turned off a lot of people who liked it who were political. So they've lost a lot because of them weighing in politics. You know, when I want to go to a restaurant or I want to go to the theater, I don't want to see that. I mean, I'm a guy who's involved in it, and I obviously believe there's a place. But the left is obsessed, Ronnie, with politicizing everything. Everything. Everything has to be, if you don't go to the, you know, if the restaurateur owner does something that's not good, boycott. If this team's person says, I believe in traditional marriage, boycott their food. If this person says, you know what, maybe we should slow up immigration because the town is now 50% over capacity and we got to, he's a racist, boycott. It's that type of, you can't, freedom of speech is dying. And it's in social media, especially Twitter, and Twitter's dominated by the left. We know that. Twitter, the users, it is a left-wing platform. There are some right-wing, but it's 3-to-1 minimum Democrat activists. And all they do is sit there with their blue check mark thinking they're important. Oh, I got to opine on this. No one really cares. You know how it is? But unfortunately, the media, it's a cycle. You see how it goes. And I don't know if it's going to get better.
No, you know, this is the most polarized situation I can remember since I remember I've read about it, but since the 60s at least, and maybe since, I don't know, but you know, I can't remember really any time where the United States have been this polarized. What is the solution? I mean, how do you turn the, I mean, how do you avoid a new civil war, basically?
My view is I think if I could lead a movement, it's called Turn It Off, and that is turn off media. Turn off corrupt corporate media. I think with YouTube, with the internet, if you want to know in something, I do all my own research. So I go, I read a bunch of different articles, different sources to come to an opinion, right? I look at different YouTube videos. I go do your own research. Don't be plugged into one channel, one celebrity, one. They're not news people. They're entertainment. They're proper. Their goal is to keep your eyes glued to make money on advertising. Okay, they're there to keep you fearful that, you know, the satanic variant of COVID is the next one. So stay indoors or keep watching us. I wish people would red pill themselves and wake up. Everybody, I want Democrats to wake up. I want Republicans to wake up. I want everybody to turn it off and be independent minded. That's my Will I lead that movement? Well, I don't know if I'll be successful, but I tell everyone, I tell my family, I tell anyone, regardless of their political stripe, go do your own. Don't watch, you know, MSNBC. Don't look at the New York Times. Don't believe everything on Newsmax or whatever. Do your own investigation.
Yeah. My final question. Now, you said you were an idealist, and you know, what do you think is, why do you think the Republican Party is so important?
Well, I mean, I think the Republican Party is the only legitimate party that we have that is fighting for some shred of limited government, fiscal responsibility, and kind of the founding principles of the Constitution. And, you know, no one's complete. I'm not saying you don't have cultural changes and things adapt, but you have a party that wants to, and the Democrats that basically want to have, you know, men do women's sports if they want to. They're all about identity. They're obsessed with race. They're obsessed with what your identity is. They don't care about the individual. They're based in victimhood. They want to tear down statues and erase everybody. I mean, everybody. You know, today's Jefferson's birthday. They don't like Jefferson. He owned slaves, this, that. They don't look at anything in historic context. And I think, and as someone who's a person who studied history and has a degree in it too, I love history. I teach some American Revolution courses, but I always teach, you got to teach everything. I mean, and you're not hiding the scars of America. We have them, but they're just hell bent on tearing down stuff. So I think the Republican Party, for the most part, the people who make up it, and don't confuse the party, because the party apparatus and the people in it, I don't have them much faith in their political hacks who aren't. But the average person who votes or thinks more of this side, I think it's the only thing preserving, you know, keeping this country on the right track. There are dumb politicians in both, but it's the only vehicle we have, Ronnie, to, I think, a limited constitutional government that was envisioned in our founders.
I totally agree. And that, you know, that brings me to one more question, since you have lived here in Sweden, because, you know, the attitude here in Sweden is basically among the journalists and the media that when they analyze and the United States, they basically portray the Republicans as the intolerant party and the, you know, the crazy right-wing Christians and things like that, and the Democrats as the progressive, you know, more social democratic-minded, you know, intellectual people. You know, do you have any thoughts about that, you know, about the image of the United States here in Sweden?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll say one of the things that disturbed me when I was in Sweden, I remember watching a program on public service about the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. Now, I've lived here my whole life. I've never met one or seen one Klan rally. I'm not saying they don't exist, but this Swedish program made it look like they were right at the end of my driveway. They were at the post office. They're out when I'm shopping. They're killing my dog. I mean, it was the worst. I thought to myself, what in the hell is this? This is not true. The Swedish media is just as bad as what you said. They don't know. And look, the Republican Party doesn't have the best spokespeople, or they don't do themselves any favor. Okay. I do agree with that. But the media in Sweden portrays them as a bunch of, and the voters that make up, and that's not true. A lot of the Republican voters are, you meet them, they're a lot of business people. They just want to be left alone. They're not racist. They're not going around looking for this. They just, if you're a good person, they like you. If you're a jerk, they don't want to be around you. It's that simple. They're not looking like, the Democrats are ID, they're like, oh, I need a gay person, I need a transgender, I need five Latinos, they're all identity. More Republicans are, hey, do I get along with you? All right, you're good with me. I like you. Let's be friends. I take the individual. The Democrats are more all about group, all about victim. And no one in Sweden who hasn't been here and interacted will understand. Like, the media wouldn't understand that.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, in that case, thanks a lot, Ryan Traffic, for this very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Det var avsnitt 1306 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, en podcast som finns för att ge det konservativa perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd gärna med en gåva på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller via hemsidan på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för den här gången. Tack för att ni har lyssnat.